Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In 2003 alone, more than 3.5 million children under the age of 15 needed medical treatment for sports injuries, and almost half of these were the result of simple overuse, something that 20 years ago we just didn't see. And a lot of people say this is a symptom of a much larger problem in the way we think about sports and young people. This morning in this hour, we'll talk about the evolution of youth sports with journalist Mark Hyman. He says that what started out as something for kids has in many cases become, in effect, a professional training ground, something that is ill-suited to the physical and emotional needs of young players. At the same time, he says it is possible that positive changes can be made. He's written about this in his recent book, Until It Hurts, America's Obsession with Youth Sports and How It Harms Our Kids. Beacon Press is the publisher of the book if you want to take a look at it. Mark Hyman is a sports journalist. He writes frequently about the business of sports, sports and the law, and about the role of adults in youth sports. And since 2000, he's been contributing editor for sports business at Business Week. Before that, he spent 20 years as a reporter for newspapers, including the Baltimore Sun, the Baltimore News, American, the Dallas Times Herald, and the Philadelphia Bulletin. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions from listeners are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask is that when people call in, they try to keep their comments brief so we can keep moving along, get in as many different callers as possible. But certainly, questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Hyman, hello.
David, thank you for that very nice introduction.
Well, we certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time. It seems that very clearly here, your bottom line is that in many respects, we've lost sight of what sports programs for kids are supposed to be about, that is, running around, having some fun, making friends, learning about teamwork, and that too often what we see here is that young athletes, and particularly their parents, are approaching their participation in organized sports as if it was a job, or that it might one day be.
Yeah, I think the really good stuff about youth sports is very attainable. Having fun, picking up some skills in a sport, gaining self-esteem, making friends. I mean, every kid can pick those things up playing sports. But increasingly, it seems that we view sports for kids as kind of a career path. You know, perhaps a way for a kid to get a college scholarship, and if we're really dreaming big, perhaps being a professional athlete. And those are really long shots, and it's a shame that sports for kids have been kind of re-engineered in ways that seem to focus the attention on those goals, which really are not all that attainable.
Yeah. And if you're looking for responsibility here, I suppose there are a number of places where we can lay responsibility, and we can talk about some of these things, about our attitude toward competition and so forth. But it seems that you, at the end of the day, you think really the main responsibility for the problem, to the extent there is a problem, is really the parents.
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely cultural factors at work here that are bearing on us every day. There's also kind of biology at work, too. I mean, we see ourselves in our kids when they're out on the field and we're watching them. We really, you know, feel that connection. It's just in our DNA. And I'm as much a part of that scene as anybody. I write in the book about some very large mistakes that I made that were costly to my son and resulted in a pretty serious injury. You know, yes, there are cultural forces at work, but I think ultimately we have to take responsibility. And if there's going to be change, it has to come at the grassroots level with, you know, individual parents making different choices.
Yeah. One indicator, and I just touched on it in opening up, one indicator of the problem and the scope of the problem does have to do with injuries. One of the things that I mentioned, and you definitely deal with in the book, is this the issue of maybe the kind of injuries that we're seeing just a couple of decades ago. It was almost unheard of.
Yeah. This is one of the real aha moments for me in doing the reporting for the book. 20, 25 years ago, Of course there were sports injuries, but they were the kind that are kind of inherent to any sports game. A child turning an ankle, touching second base, or a quarterback hyperextending an elbow, being hit, you know, during a game. Those things are going to happen. They're not avoidable. But as many as half of the sports injuries that occur these days are the result of simple overuse, and they're totally avoidable. They only occur because kids are playing the same sport these days year-round, and you know, with the hope or expectation of playing at a higher level. And that was never the case 20 or 25 years ago, because in those days, sports wasn't viewed as a stepping stone to something greater and more ambitious. It was more of a leisure activity and about having fun.
Mm. That does seem to be a problem for at least some kids. And again, it goes back to some of the things that we've talked about and the way parents think about participation in sport can do for their children, but that we do see more and more, and maybe when we were younger, people who were particularly gifted athletically might play different sports. We had seasons for things, but now we have people, children who are potentially identified as having talent in a particular thing early on, and then they're channeled into a single sport, and that because they're so serious about it, they end up doing it all year round. And certainly I'm sure that there are now greater possibilities for doing things if you've got money and access to sports facilities and access to trainers and coaches that you actually can do this year-round.
Yeah, I mean, there are two paths that kids are taking these days. One is to kind of turn their backs on sports entirely, and as a result, 75% of kids have dropped out of sports programs by age 13. 75%, I mean, that's a staggering figure, I think. So you have that path, which is kind of a dead-end path. The kids who remain are on a much more competitive path. And there are two changes that I'd like to mention. One is that kids are starting much earlier in sports than they ever have. In my day, and I'm not that old, but it was typical for kids to start in sports at age 8 or 9. Now that's almost mid-career for some kids. It's much more typical now for kids to start at 3 or 4. And there's one national soccer program that enrolls kids at 18 months. So that's one big change. And the other is this specialization idea that you mentioned, where often at age 7 or 8, a child is a particular sport is identified as a child's best sport. And with encouragement from coaches and other parents, a kid will begin playing and practicing in that sport year-round. So you might have a child who's a soccer player playing in the fall and doing some kind of fitness training in the off-season, maybe playing indoors in the off-season, taking private lessons from a college coach or a former professional player, and going to a summer camp where they will work on a particular skill or skills that are specific even to a particular position. So before long, you have kids who are doing nothing but playing that particular sport. And though they become much more skilled than players were in our generation, they're also much more vulnerable to injury for that reason.
You talked a moment or so ago about the fact that there are a lot of kids who, by their early teens, just drop out of sports, and I wonder how much of that is either getting burned out on it because they have been pushed, and maybe in part because they wanted to, went at it way too hard, and how much of that is those young people who might like to play and would be okay, but not superstars, and they might think because of all of the attention that the best players get, they might look at themselves and their ability to perform and say, well, I'm no good at this. I'm never going to be good at this. What's the point? I'll just not even do it.
Yeah, I think everything that you've said is true of various groups of kids. The kids who are dropping out by age 13, we know why they're dropping out. There have been a number of studies that have pursued that with kids, and they say the things that you would expect them to say, such as, I wasn't having fun, it's too competitive, I didn't like being yelled at by the parents and the coaches. So those kids are dropping out for the obvious reasons. It just wasn't an activity that was making them happy. the kids who are more competitive, they are that's more complicated. A lot of the reporting in the book is interviews that I've done with physicians, pediatricians, and orthopedic surgeons, and they are really fascinating people speaking about this issue. And some of the stories they tell are really so insightful into this problem. For instance, I spoke to an orthopedic surgeon in L.A. who tells me that he often sees patients who come to him with an injury or complaints about an injury, and when he speaks with them alone, when their parents are not present, they tell him something very different. They concede that, yes, they've got an injury, but they really don't want to return to the sport. They would be much happier retiring from the sport, spending time with their girlfriend or playing video games or even doing homework. But they have a very difficult time confronting their parents and telling them that, you know, they really would rather drop out of the sport because their parents have invested so much emotionally and in their time and often money. They've spent so much money preparing their child and coaching their child up to a certain level that they feel that their parents are invested in ways that they just don't want to let their parents down.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Mark Hyman. He's a sports journalist. He is a contributing editor for Sports Business at Businessweek. And one of the things that he's written about is the role of adults in youth sports. And he is the author of the book Until It Hurts, America's Obsession with Youth Sports and How It Harms Our Kids. It's published by Beacon Press. So if you're interested, you can seek the book out. Questions are welcome here. Questions, comments are welcome here on the show. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that you write about in the book is a little bit of the history of the development of youth sports. And it's interesting that, as you write in the book, say before about 1920, before the 20s, organized sports were school-based. Parents just weren't that much involved. But then we come to a point where school started to cut sports, and then parents really got involved at that. And that's the point where we see the creation of things like Little League and football for small players and other kinds of sports programs that then really takes off, say, after World War II and draws in a lot of adults.
Yeah, this was a surprise to me. In the teens and 20s, as you say, sports for kids were primarily school-based and became quite competitive in ways that would be familiar to us. But educators who had more of an academic perspective rejected that model. They were concerned about what they were seeing. And at that point, there was this change where the schools reverted to more of an intramural and recreational and participation approach to sports. So by the late 1920s, you didn't have that competitive aspect in sports for kids. So there was this void created, and into that breach stepped parents, because parents had a very different perspective on what they wanted for their kids' sports lives. And that's when you have the rise of programs like the forerunner to Pop Warner football in the late 1920s. And then, of course, the granddaddy of them all, Little League Baseball, which started in 1939 and kind of opened the floodgates in terms of parents taking a very active and hands-on role in the lives of the sports lives of their kids.
Yeah. The other thing in this section I think that's really interesting is that as far back as, say, the 30s, people were raising concerns about organized youth sport, and some of the things that they were saying then, they're the same things that we're saying now.
Well, you've read the book very carefully. It's great that you picked up on that. And that was another surprise to me. Now, my sense of it was that this kind of backlash and concern about sports for kids and where it was going was a relatively recent phenomenon. But to my surprise, that's not the case at all. In the 1930s, you had academics writing about the dangers of specialization, for instance. Now, you know, I'm sure kids weren't specializing in those days the way they are today. But there was an awareness that this was a growing trend and concern about it. And then in the 1950s, you had a chorus, basically, of critics ranging from educators to physicians to former professional athletes. The first Little Leaguer to play in the major leagues was a pitcher named Joey Jay, who was a very successful pitcher in the 50s and 60s for the Cincinnati Reds. in the 1960s, he wrote a piece for a national magazine about that was as critical of Little League as anything that's been written, you know, in the last 15 years. He was just a very virulent opponent of what Little League baseball had become, and that was in 1966.
We have a caller here. We'd like to get some others, but we'll get our first in, and this is someone who's listening in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yes, I'm impressed with the topic, but I kind of want to look at it from another angle. I don't know if your book explores it. I think certain demographic groups are particularly hard hit in terms of aspirations that really matter in this society by the emphasis on sports. I'm speaking of African-Americans, particularly African-American young men, and how many of them in their inner city or even here in an area like Champaign-Urbana, which lies in the shadows of the University of Illinois and Parkland College, are raised in a culture whereby their hope of moving out of their environment, impoverished environment for the most part, are tied to, by their parents primarily, to playing sports, particularly football and basketball. And I just think that works to their disadvantage because, as you say, a long shot exists for a college or a scholarship or an NBA career or an NFL career. And I think what sacrifice, even though I only have anecdotal evidence of this, is a desire to engage in the academics of elementary, middle school, or high school, where the real long-range goals can be met. Do you have any thoughts about that?
It's a wonderful call, and thank you for raising this point. You know, this goes back to the odds that we spoke about earlier. Fewer than 3% of high school basketball players end up playing in college, and the percentage of those kids who actually earn athletic scholarships is even lower than that. So it's a real bad bet. And one of my hopes for the book is to connect the dots for parents and help kind of increase understanding of the fact that this is not a career path. It's not the way to get your kid educated in college. You do much better to spend time with them studying biology than encouraging them to play basketball if your expectation is a college scholarship. Now, I mean, I love sports for kids. I have two kids. I've been a coach. I've been the president of a local league. I'm not an opponent of sports for kids in any way. I just think our expectations need to be adjusted.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you. Well, this, you know, when you think about the cost of college education today and that we probably have every reason to expect the cost is going to continue to go up. For an awful lot of parents, the idea that maybe they could get a college scholarship for their child if he or she was a gifted enough athlete is so tempting, I find it difficult to get too much down on somebody if that's really what it is they're thinking about.
Well, you know, David, we're so vulnerable as parents when we're watching our kids and hoping for good things for our kids, particularly when our kids are, say, ages 9 to 13, because you really don't know what the possibilities are athletically for your child when they are that age. And I can tell you that personally, when my older son was 9, 10, 11, he was a good recreation league pitcher, and he was striking out all the kids on the other team. And you know, it's very easy to kind of start dreaming and wonder if he will always be striking out all of the other batters on the other team. So it's absolutely natural and understandable that parents are dreaming big for their kids, but that shouldn't be the basis for their participation in sports. I think when that becomes the motivating factor, that's when our judgment can be bad things.
Yeah. And the other thing that it certainly is true that I'm sure that we have parents and maybe a growing number of parents who, if they have a child, and maybe the child seems to have some talent or some interest, and they start thinking, well, you know, maybe my daughter really could become some kind of superstar. And I suppose the thing that the thing that everybody's going to think of, the story that has made a big impression on a lot of people, was the story of Tiger Woods.
Yeah. And I write about that in the book. I write about a TV show in 1978 that I think a lot of people have heard about, and maybe some in your audience actually saw. When Tiger was two, he and his dad appeared on the Mike Douglas Show. And to give you a sense of how long ago that was, the other guests on the show were Bob Hope and Jimmy Stewart. So those were the guests, Tiger Woods, Bob Hope, Jimmy Stewart. And Tiger kind of toddled out onto the stage with his dad, and they'd set up a little practice tee area on the stage, and he hit a couple of balls into a net. And that was a very powerful moment, I think, for parents, because it gives us the sense. It's kind of a marker. It gave us a sense that, yeah, if you started young enough and you trained your child intensively enough, you might be able to create this, you know, athlete of the century. And it's true that the Tiger story had a very happy ending. But for every Tiger, there thousands, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of kids who started that young and trained that actively, and, you know, nothing really happened. So I think we have to keep that in mind.
I wonder what kind of advice you would give, or how you would think about a family where, say, the parents start the child out in a sport just because they think maybe it would be good for them to be involved in sport for all the right reasons. And so you have a child that maybe early on starts to show some real talent and promise. They stand above their peers, and they do it more and more. They're good at it. They really like it. And you're very excited about that. But that some of the drive to do it actually comes from the child, that they seem to really be into it. They love doing it. They think, I'm really good at this. This is very exciting. And, you know, maybe as you're a parent, you're kind of concerned that they're maybe overdoing it. And they come to you and they say, Dad, but I love this. I'm really good at this. I could be really, really good at this. You know, one day you could see me standing up on the podium getting a gold medal in the Olympics. I really want to go for this. You know, let me give it everything that I've got. And, you know, maybe you as a parent have conflicted feelings about that, because you think, well, you know, that really would be something to see them get a gold medal, and maybe they really are that good. And yet, on the other hand, you would have the kind of concerns that you voiced here, that, well, I'm not sure that that's such a good thing, and maybe they'd get hurt, and maybe they would be very disappointed, and maybe somehow it just won't pan out that way. I mean, how do you address what genuinely seems to be the desire of the child to do it?
Well, I guess I have a couple of thoughts about that. Number one, you know, that's where you earn your money as a parent. You know, those are the very tough judgment calls that parents make all the time. And, you know, I'm in no position to really harshly judge other parents who are wrestling with that. I mean, in my own case, I allowed my son to play baseball, you know, basically 8 months out of the year. And he had a great time, but ultimately the outcome was not entirely happy, because he suffered a very serious elbow injury that was a classic overuse injury. So I wouldn't substitute my judgment for those of parents. But let me make a couple of other points. Mm-hmm. There's really no data to support the notion that if your child specializes early and trains very aggressively, you know, from a very young age, that you can turn your kid into a college or professional athlete. And there's some research cited in the book that I think raises questions about whether that's whether it makes sense to draw those conclusions. And the second point is that, you know, physicians are very concerned about this. This is not, you know, only a journalist speaking about this issue. The book is really a reported book. And so many physicians and medical societies are raising questions about, look, if this is your long-term goal to play in college or even professionally, don't throw that away by making yourself vulnerable to injury. And the kids who are doing that, playing year-round, their careers are often cut short. Perhaps they have the athletic ability, But because of the wear and tear on their bodies, they don't get that opportunity because of the physical damage they've done to themselves.
We have another call here. Someone on a cell phone in Champaign. Let's talk with them. Line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call. Great show. I entered the conversation late, so you'll forgive me if you've already touched on this, but had two quick points. To dovetail back on a previous caller, if you haven't mentioned this, there was a wonderful documentary put out some time ago called Hoop Dreams, basically about these two kids from the south side of Chicago and travails of them hanging their hats on a basketball career and what happened to them and the odds, as you mentioned, you know, how completely against an individual they are. But then the flip side of that is there was some time ago, 70s, there was a defensive player for the Chicago Bears, and this guy made it all the way through. You know, he beat the odds. And I think he was with the Bears for 2 years, and he blew out his knee, and his career was done. And because he had hung his hat on becoming a professional football player, basically, again, with this documentary, this guy, you know, he had almost nothing to fall back on, no skills, no other talents. And I think that's the flip side of, you know, going kind of putting all your eggs in one basket, because even if you do make it as a professional athlete, chances are your career is going to be very short anyway. And I was just wondering if your guest wanted to comment on that. Thanks.
Yeah, this goes back to the earlier point about sports for kids as, you know, some sort of perceived career path. It really doesn't make sense to pursue it in that way. And as I said, that's when the problems begin, when we get invested in ways that cloud our judgment. There are lots of stories in the book about parents who take their children to physicians to be treated for overuse injuries. And when the recommended treatment is rest for the child, the parents can't accept it because they're so invested in their child staying on the field, improving their performance, you know, climbing the rankings, that they have a difficult time setting that aside and seeing what's in the, you know, the long-term interest of their kid. And these aren't bad parents at all. They're just parents who've been disarmed by this idea that sports, you know, it becomes an identity, not only for their kids, but for them. Their friendships are based on people they've met at sporting events for their kids. They've got a lot of money tied up in it. They're dreaming big. And that, as I said, that's when you're really vulnerable.
We are at our midpoint, actually just a little bit past. Our guest is Mark Hyman. He's a sports journalist who writes about the business of sports, about the role of adults in youth sports. Since 2000, he's been contributing editor for Sports Business at Business Week and has also written over his career as a journalist for other papers, including the Baltimore Sun, the Baltimore News American, the Dallas Times Herald, the Philadelphia Bulletin. He's the author of a recent book, and the title of the book is Until It Hurts, America's Obsession with Youth Sports and How It Harms Our Kids, and the publisher is Beacon Books.
David, can I mention that, yeah, that the book, there's a book website.
Sure, sure.
It's called UntilItHurts.com, and that was an easy name to come up with. And I mention it for a number of reasons, one of which is that my son, who is now 20, has written a piece from a child, well, he's not a child anymore, but from a youth player's perspective on what happened to him and his parents' role in an injury that occurred. And I think it's a good complement to the discussion we're having.
All right, great. And, of course, other people who are listening, if you have questions, comments, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think that when it comes to youth sports, one of the things that we would have to say has been a good thing over the past few decades has been as a result of this thing called Title IX, there are many more opportunities for girls to be involved in sport than there were back, say, in the 50s or even in the 60s. And at the same time, though, we see some of the same problems with girls and their participation in sport as we do with boys. And I think you talk in the book about an interesting case study, something that maybe would be new to folks, those folks who have heard, who has not heard of Michael Phelps. The case here is of his sister, Whitney, who I guess at one point people thought might be as great, maybe even a better swimmer than her brother, her younger brother, and that she really had a really bad experience and got hurt And nobody, so now today, everybody knows about Michael Phelps, but nobody knows about Whitney.
Yeah, Whitney Phelps is 5 years older than Michael. And when people in Baltimore talked about the Phelps family in the early 1990s, and they spoke about a Phelps swimmer who was Olympic caliber, nobody was talking about Michael Phelps. They were talking about Whitney. She was just a dynamite swimmer. I mean, from the age of 10, she was just incredibly driven and accomplished and competitive and was winning races wherever she was swimming. She was her 200-meter butterfly was her best event. And as she explained to me in the book, by age 10, she was having symptoms that were consistent with overuse. She was having pains in her back. By age 12, she was having difficulty completing workouts, and sometimes even standing was painful. But in part because she was so driven and so focused on this Olympic goal, even at that age, she was reluctant to share this fully with her coach and her mom. And they may have picked up on signals because she was physically compromised for, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years. But they were also very invested in her success, you know, wanted the best for her, but also were caught up in what was going on. And, you know, Whitney was a ranked swimmer and the favorite, really, to go to the Olympics in 1996 in her event. But she failed at the Olympic trials to qualify. She needed to finish third, and she finished sixth, which was a shock to everyone. It was assumed that she would win. And the reason was that she was just spent physically. She was an orthopedic surgeon's nightmare by that time. She had stress fractures and bulging discs and all sorts of things. And she never competed in an Olympic trials again after that. And it took her a long time to really embrace Michael's success because she felt that it could have been her. And in a way, I mean, didn't blame her mom, certainly, but had mixed feelings about the role that her coach played in not recognizing her physical problems. And it's a Phelps story without a happy ending, that's for sure.
Well, that, and I think that underscores the point of how important it is for parents to be really tuned in to their kids and what's going on with them, because there certainly are cases, this is one, and I'm sure there are a lot of others, where both because of parents' expectations and because what children want, kids are driving themselves, and there are times when the kids are hurting and they're keeping it to themselves. And you might say, well, that's a pretty poor excuse if parents, you know, that parents should be able to know, but I imagine probably there are also some kids that are probably able to do a pretty good job of keeping it to themselves.
Well, I interviewed Murray Stevens for the book, and Murray was Whitney's coach and is a, you know, highly successful and respected swim coach who has trained lots of Olympic swimmers. You know, and he said something to me that was very interesting. He said, look, when you're training to be an Olympian, you're testing your physical limits by definition. And it's not always clear what those limits are, and sometimes you're going to exceed them, and sometimes you're going to sustain a career-ending injury. And that's kind of the way he viewed it. And that makes total sense to me, except for the fact that we're talking about a 12-year-old. And at some level, I think the adults need to step up and make judgments for the child. I wouldn't expect a 12-year-old to approach a situation as serious as Whitney's, you know, with the experience and wisdom that adults would.
We have some other callers. Let's talk with them. Next is someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've been in sports medicine for 30 years now, and one of the things I've found is that children will tend to succeed up through sophomore year in high school, and then they're done with their sport. And one of the things we don't appreciate at 10, 11, 12 years old is the fact that this child who is bigger and faster and stronger than his peers will eventually be caught up with by those peers. And when that happens, they tend to lose interest in sports. I'll hang up now.
All right. Well, I don't know. Is that something you have some thoughts about?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's this big issue called puberty. And, you know, we can get very excited about the athletic prospects of our kids when they're 10 and 11. You know, in my case, my son was tall for his age, and he was that was part of the reason for his success. Not all of it, but a part of it. But as the caller said, when your child is 14 or 15, that, you know, calculus can change very dramatically. So, you know, we've got to be aware of the fact that, you know, because your child is a great athlete or a dominant in their sport at age 11 or 12, that's not a great predictor of what they're going to be doing on the sports field when they're 15 or 16.
Okay, next we'll talk with someone here in Urbana where we are, line two. Hello?
Hi.
Yes.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
My daughter, Ella Masser, is a local sports star of sorts. She plays soccer. And she, when she was 3 years old, she would get this faraway look, and she would just say, I can be faster than him or him. Her brother was an athlete, too. It was a case of her being completely, almost in a fantasy land of seeing herself powerful, strong, and able to, well, beat the boys, for sure. She wasn't bigger, and she wasn't particularly stronger, but she did love it. I had no interest in her being an athlete, although her father had played college football. But he played so well. He's the kind of guy that can catch a fly in midair that he never drilled the kids. He wasn't like someone who was trying to get excellence or let's shoot a million baskets. No, we did the pirouette. I was a dancer, so we would just play on the basketball field or court, see, field, basketball field, what I know about sports. Anyway, she was scooped up by this community almost more than her family. She became her coach's dreams, and there was a lot of emphasis on how great she was. It bothered me a lot because, well, frankly, I don't think she got much of an education at all, either at high school or she really majored in soccer. That's what she knows. And we talked a lot about, or at least I talked a lot about, okay, what was it like to lose that time? What was it like, sort of the team ethic of sports, which was new to me. And that was something that was very valuable, playing with other women and getting to know them and working with different coaches and all of the ins and outs of getting, let's say, a new coach, like her career as a kid, Little Illini soccer, and there would be a new coach every couple of years, and she would adapt to that coach, and the coaches themselves were interesting. So there was a whole megillah about this. Lots of things she learned, adapting to different teams, to different players, and so on and so forth, sort of the experience, the psychological experience of being a good player and a driven player on a team. But when she was in high school, she got compartmental system syndrome. She went to an expert in Madison, Wisconsin, who specializes in treating mostly young women for this phenomenon. And what it is the fascia don't expand enough to hold the muscles that are being so super developed. And so they have to be cut in order to let that muscle have some relief. I guess what she experienced was like tremendous shin splints. And that operation was, of course, far more than it seemed like it would be. People told us, well, it's just like cutting up a chicken, you know, that white stuff around the muscle. That's all it is. But it was a tremendous operation. So I'm agreeing with you in everything that you're saying. And then also coming back that her experience with the people in sports, at least in this town, has been quite marvelous. It's a whole world out there, and a lot of people in sports are very concerned and very caring, trainers who helped her. So that's all I want to say. I mean, now she's, you know, 2 years out of, or 1 year out of college, and she's giving the commencement address at her high school, which I feel kind of funny about, too. I mean, what does it mean for these kids to hear an athlete give the commencement address? And I'm hoping that she'll talk something about some of her experiences with winning and losing. Anyway, I'll shut up. I don't really have anything to say except sharing my experience. Thanks for your
call. Well, thank you for the call. I don't know what your thoughts are about that, but I guess, it takes me back to the earlier question I asked about, well, how, as a parent, how do you deal with a child that really seems to, the motivation for doing the sport really seems to come from within them?
There's nothing wrong with the child participating in a sport at a young age and having fun with it. I think the parent just has to keep in perspective what the ultimate goal is. And as long as it's about having fun and getting better and, making friends, I think those are all wonderful and achievable goals. We all love our children. I interviewed 200 people for this book. I didn't meet a single parent who I thought had anything but the best intentions for their child. So we're not debating that. We're not debating the motives of the parents. It's trying to navigate this landscape and trying to figure out what's best for your child. And, oftentimes we live in a culture where we think more is always better. We equate the two. More is better. And more is not always better, particularly when it comes to sports for kids at a very early age.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Mark Hyman. He's a sports journalist. Since 2000, he's been contributing editor for Sports Business at Businessweek, and he writes about the business of sports, also about the role of adults in youth sports, and he's the author of the book Until It Hurts, America's Obsession with Youth Sports and How It Harms Our Kids, published by Beacon Press. We have some other callers here. We'll go on and next talk with someone on cell phone, line 3. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'm actually a little disappointed about specialization for kids in all things. When my kids were in high school, and that was not in this area, but we were in California, and I naively, as a parent, thought this was a great opportunity for them to try out different things and learn what they were good at, and instead, everything from my son's soccer team to the golf team to the music class to the theater class involves staying at school from 3 to 6 and intensive. Everyone, thought that their field was the most important thing for this kid. And it was kind of disappointing that when do you get to just try something and dabble in things? And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on that as a parent. How do we get back to that place?
Well, I can speak about it in a sports context. It's very difficult now for kids 13, 14, 15 who do not want to be Major League Baseball players, for instance, to find an organized league to play in, because we've kind of reached the stage where at that age the leagues become highly competitive. And I think one of the reasons is that the parents of the more competitive kids, they're more invested. So they're interested in being the organizers and the coaches and underwriting these leagues. And the parents of the kids who are not quite as gifted, they kind of drift away. So there are not a lot of 14-year-old baseball players who are not able to play at the high school level, say, but want to play recreationally. There are not many opportunities for those kids. I think that's a real shame, and I think that parents ought to, that's something we can do something about. But we have to step up as parents and say, hey, we recognize that there's value in sports just as recreation and not as a stepping stone to even high school, much less college.
One more caller here, Charleston, line 1. Hello.
Yes, hi. I was just kind of thinking about how we have a ad on the local radio station down here by an orthopedic surgeon. He says, we're here to keep your kid in the game. And that always struck me kind of odd, too. Also, it seems like parents, are part of the blame, but part of the blame, I think, are the coaches, that a lot of this is for the greater honor and glory of the coaches and of the school, and the kids just get all of that kind of thing. And you're right, they get discouraged early on because of the pressure, because of the amount of time commitment that they're being asked to put into it. And when I was growing up in the late 50s, early 60s, you know, we called each other up on the phone and got together and played sandlot basketball or baseball, and you hardly see any of that going on anymore, because if you're not on the team at the school, you're just not playing. Comments?
Well, you know, I don't, there are millions of volunteer coaches in this country, and I applaud 90% of them. I think they have the right goals, and, you know, they've got the interests of the kids at heart. But I also think that, you know, let's be honest, we all have our agendas. And let's say you're a professional coach and you're, you know, you teach gymnastics. You know, your livelihood depends on your ability to train up kids to be expert gymnasts and spread the word that your gym is the place to be. So your agenda is not the same as the parent of that child or the child, him or herself. We're all invested in the status quo in ways that I think are not helpful to children. And, you know, again, I'm just hoping that the book will start a conversation and help us rethink whether we're on the right path and whether what we're doing is really in the interest of most kids.
Yeah. We're coming down to the point where we have maybe have 4 or 5 minutes, and we have talked, much of what we have talked about here is negative. I want to make sure, though, before we end up out of time, to see if we can somehow end on a slightly positive note, because you do have some examples of programs you think are doing the right thing, and one in particular I'd like to have you mention, in part because it's in our neighboring state, is a program in Fort Wayne.
Yeah, and thanks for the opportunity to do this, because I don't think it's a negative book, and I don't think it's a pessimistic book. It is plain speaking, but I don't think of it as negative. And examples like the Wildcat Baseball League in Fort Wayne are one of the reasons. It's a youth baseball league for kids, I think it's 7 to 14, something like that. And it's unique in two respects. First, all of the games are played during the day, so all of the pressures about scheduling games around mealtime are not a problem in the Wildcat League. The second is that parents are very peripheral to this league. They're permitted to come to games, but they're not encouraged to. They're not permitted to serve as coaches. The coaches are high school and college athletes. And they're not assigned to individual teams. There are two assigned to each game, one as a bench coach for both teams, the other as an umpire. So the coaches are not invested in the outcome of the game because they're constantly moving from team to team. And the games sometimes stop so that the coaches can work on individual skills. And, you know, it's more about learning and having fun and being out with your friends than it is about going home with a trophy at the end of the year. I just think it's a wonderful model.
Yeah. Just we come back, I guess, we keep coming back to the parents, because you said in the beginning that if, to a large extent, if there is a problem, it's, we have to lay a lot of that responsibility at the door of the parent. And then we'd also say that the responsibility for maybe doing things differently, also we lay that at the door of the parent. One thing I think about, and you see these stories from time to time in the news about examples of spectacular bad sportsmanship exhibited by parents who were there in attendance of their children. And even now and again, we've seen stories where actually it leads to violence involving parents and coaches and players. And you just sort of have to shake your head and say, what? How did we get to this point? And I guess I feel that part of the thing is that if you are a parent and you do see something like that, that you can't just let it slide. You have to somehow find a way to say, look, that's just not acceptable behavior. And can you just take a second here and think about the lesson that maybe without intending, the lesson that you are teaching your child and these other children here?
It's, you know, when I read about these examples, and some of them are in the book, some of the most egregious examples I've kind of collected in the book to make a point. You know, to me, it just underscores how invested we are. I think that's a big part of the issue, that we're so invested emotionally and financially, and we're giving so much of our time that we can't, you know, watch this from a safe emotional distance. We're very wrapped up ourselves. In, you know, it's kind of a referendum on our parenting. And I can tell you that myself, that when, you know, when my child was succeeding on a sports field, it's kind of silly to admit this, but I stood a little bit taller, and I maybe felt a little bit better about myself. And it's not a rational. It can't be explained rationally. You know, it's just kind of a human nature phenomenon. But, and we're not going to do away with that. Parents are always going to care deeply about their kids and want their kids to succeed and feel for them when they don't. That's natural, and we don't want to do away with that. But at the same time, I think we can create a sports environment for our kids that are about them and about their interests and less about our ambitions and expectations for them.
There we'll have to stop. Our guest, Mark Hyman, is contributing editor for Sports Business at Businessweek and also writes about the role of adults in youth sports. His book is Until It Hurts, America's Obsession with Youth Sports and How It Harms Our Kids, published by Beacon Press. You might take a look at the website for the book. That's untilitehurts.com. Is that right?
That's right.
All right. Thanks very much for spending some time with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, David.